From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on September 25th, 2000, San Francisco. A 19-year-old man named Kevin Hines had gone to the Golden Gate Bridge, intending to jump to his death. Kevin didn't want to die. He felt he had to die to end the burden he was causing to his friends and family. That, of course, was his mental illness talking, and in some cases, talking to him specifically, telling him he had to die. It was not reality, but that was his illness. It had taken hold. So Kevin stood on the edge of the Golden Gate Bridge. More than 2,000 people have been known to end their life by suicide on that bridge. Roughly 24 had survived by the time Kevin jumped. The fall, 220 feet. 98% of jumpers die in impact with the water, the rest by drowning or hypothermia. Kevin jumped, and then something happened. In the air, he instantly regretted it. All of that stuff, all of the problems, all of the burden, it was something he could handle. He no longer felt he had to die, but it was too late. He was falling at 75 miles per hour. You are about to hear the extraordinary story of what happened next. Kevin Hines is one of a very small group to survive that fall, and he now travels the world, advocating for suicide prevention and better mental health policy. His must-read book is called Cracked, Not Broken, Surviving and Thriving After a Suicide Attempt. And today, Kevin Hines is in Rochester, a guest of NAMI, the National Association on Mental Health. They've got an event tonight. I'm told tickets are going very, very quickly. I think there's a few seats left if you want to see him tonight, but first, he's my guest for the hour on Connections. Kevin, it is great to have you. I have been so moved by your story, having seen it in multiple venues, so it's great to have you right here. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
All right. Well, I want to make sure we know what's going on tonight, so let me ask our guests to tell us what's going on tonight. Christina Mosgraber and Kimberly Van Camp are here tonight, the 14th Annual Jessica Henderson Memorial Event. So what's going on? What do we need to know about this evening?
Hi, Evan. NAMI Rochester is so thrilled to have Kevin here with us tonight. The event is at the School of the Arts on Prince Street. Doors open at 5:30. We have a wonderful evening planned. The admission is $15, and we're hoping people can join us. There are a few seats available.
Okay, and if they want to join you, how do they do that?
They can just come to the School of the Arts on Prince Street, and we'll have a registration table right as they walk in.
Well, I have been told, though, that there's not a whole lot of seating left already, that you ought to probably try to maybe get there early or figure out a way and now, because there's a lot of demand for this, yes?
We have had an overwhelming demand. We are thrilled to have Kevin here, and the community is thrilled to have him as well.
When did you guys first hear his story, by the way? I heard it last year after Robin Williams died, and we talked about it on this program, and we talked about suicide. I read a story in The New Yorker and actually mentioned Kevin's story on the air that day, not knowing I was going to meet him in person. When did you first hear his story?
I actually heard Kevin's story when I started at NAMI this past summer. Mm-hmm. I'd been very involved with NAMI as a volunteer and also as a recipient of services from NAMI, a family member, and I hadn't heard his story. And I will tell you that when I heard it, I was instantly just so moved, and I knew I was in the right place because I feel so strongly about advocating for better mental health care. And instantly, I just looked to Kevin as what a great source of inspiration, and I've been just honored to work on the event. I'm so thrilled we have so many people coming tonight. So it's a very new story for me, but I really look forward to learning more and just following you and your career and everything as it grows.
Well, let's let him tell the story. And for our audience, this is not just for people who know someone who have thought about suicide, who have attempted suicide. This is for all of us, number one. And I think we all know somebody with depression. You know, what are the numbers now? 20 to 25% of Americans, something along those lines? You know,
it's 1 in 4.
One in four. Okay, so yeah, it's 1 in 4 Americans. And we know someone with depression. We know someone who has battled these challenges. But for you, Kevin Hines, you were 19. You'd been diagnosed at 17 with what?
With bipolar disorder type 1 with psychotic features.
Okay, and what did that mean for you? In your book, you talk about the voices, for example. Take me through some of that.
For me, that means I have the manic highs, the euphoric highs caused not by drugs, not by recreational activities, but by your brain. The depressive lows, paranoid feelings, extreme paranoia, delusions of grandeur, and hallucinations, both auditory and visual, including panic attacks as well.
And you heard voices telling you you had to die.
I had heard voices for some time, maybe a lot of that year in 2000. The first voices I ever heard were in fourth grade, but I never told anyone for fear of their reaction and because I didn't know what it was. But I heard voices that day And all the way up until getting to the bridge, they were screaming in my head that I had to die, that I had no other option.
And so you prepared for it in some sense by writing a note to your family, thinking about, you said your goodbye to your father that day, thinking to yourself, no one who loves me will ever see me again.
Yeah, I would cease to exist as of that day. And I remember looking at my dad as he dropped me off, and I'll say this in the speech, he looked at me, and he said what he's always said to me. He said, Kevin, I love you. Be careful. And I kissed him on the cheek, and I told him I loved him. And as he drove away, that's the last time I'll ever see anybody I love, and very same, the last time anybody I love will ever see me. And you know what? At that moment, I was content. Suicidologists, psychologists will tell you that there is a feeling of ambivalence that occurs right up before an attempt of suicide that you don't quite have prior to. Now, my father had attempted to get me to stay with him that day because he was worried about me, but I couldn't reach out, even though I was in desperate pain. And that's really what we'll talk about tonight, the common denominator of people who live with suicidal ideations who are struggling mentally. There's an epic amount of what I deem, what I call brain pain that's going on. And I was on that bridge, and I believed that there was no other option, and I did what I did.
You knew the numbers, I think, pretty well, didn't you, that you were probably going to die when you hit the water. That's how most people die, right?
Yeah. Well, actually, to be frank, it's often a very slow and violent death. There are a great percentage of people that die upon impact, yes. But the rest of the people, I wouldn't even put it on the internet or on the radio station because it's so horrific the way people die from the Golden Gate Bridge. People think you just fall into an abyss and you disappear. And oftentimes for a lot of people, that's not the case.
Mm, okay. And so for you, the book tells the story of those moments leading up to it, the people you saw on the way out to the bridge. And you find yourself on that spot and you run and you go over the edge. And do you still remember what it looked like to you? Because you jumped essentially head down, right? You're falling first. At that moment, you're falling head down.
Yeah, I mean, to not get into the nitty-gritty detail of the actual jump, because that can lead people to think about it, but I'll say this. I thought it was over. And upon the millisecond of free fall, I had what I call an instant regret. The recognition that I had just made the worst mistake of my life. What happened to me was that I was in psychosis, believing I had to die, believing I had no other option. But the actual act of attempting, and that millisecond between life and death, I was shocked into reality. The reality that I'm 19, a good person, and the reality that I don't need to die, nor do I want to. I thought I had to. And as I fell, you know, my words were these: what have I just done? I don't want to die. God, please save me.
But you had 4 seconds to figure
four
it out.
Seconds
you had 4 seconds to
figure it out. 4 seconds
to
think those thoughts and then hit the water.
And you hit the water basically feet down. You said kind of in a sitting position, yeah?
That's what I was told, yeah.
Okay. Which turned out to be, whether you want to call it providence or luck, enough to have saved you, but it didn't save you in a way. Because, again,
Physically, it. What happened was, and I'll get into this tonight, is the actual injuries that occurred, because they were massive. Without giving it away, there were three miracles that came into play that I call them my three miracles that came into play to save my life, and I'll save that for tonight. But I'm lucky to be alive. I'm lucky to have been given a second chance at life, and I will tell you that having gone through that, I want no one else to, if they're feeling that brain pain, that mental crisis, and you're in a state of suicidal ideation, and you believe you can tell no one, there's the mistake. There's the misnomer that you have to tell someone. You have to tell anyone, everyone close to you, and wait for someone who can comprehend, empathize with what you're going through, and get you to a safe place or situation, or just sitting down and waiting until that time passes where you're in that suicidal crisis or that suicidal state. Suicide is not the solution to any problem, and it happens almost 1 million times a year annually around the globe. We're talking about people of all ages who get into a state of being where they believe they are useless, worthless, less than, and a burden to others. And that is just not the case. You see, I thought that my family hated me. I thought they wanted me dead. And I will tell you, that is a common feeling for people in this state of mind. And it is a distorted reality. So the point to make here and at this event this evening is that if you are in suicidal crisis, if you are contemplating these thoughts or ideations, you are not, nor have you ever been, alone in this fight. Millions of people suffer with depression that leads to suicidal crisis and attempts every year. You're not alone, and NAMI can help you. These family-to-family classes that they have, 12-week courses to teach families and their friends and loved ones about suicide prevention and mental health and how to heal. You know, you can heal. You can find hope. I live with this illness, this disease. It's really a disease. It's a brain disease. It's chronic. It's not going anywhere. There's no cure. I live with this disease every day. I fight it every day. But I'm glad to, because I get to be alive to do it. I get the privilege of being alive. None of us are promised tomorrow.
Saw Kevin give a presentation in Australia, and this is how much I appreciate his approach to life now. He said, I appreciate this carpet. This is a beautiful carpet. Somebody had to make this thing. And it was actually beautiful, but I thought, who's noticing the carpet? Well, Kevin Hines is. He's the author of Cracked, Not Broken, Surviving and Thriving After a Suicide Attempt. You will see the Golden Gate Bridge on the cover, and there are not many people who have ever survived to jump off the Golden Gate Bridge. He has. His story is told in the book. I recommend the book for just about anybody. It's really beautifully and at times sadly, but mostly hopefully written. And but especially if you know someone who's ever gone through any of this kind of struggle with mental illness, with disease, you know, this really is the book, I think, for them. And then a moment tonight to hear his story. So he's going to tell you more about it tonight. I'm just going to pry a few more couple little things up, but Kevin's got a lot more to tell you about what happened that day. I just have to think, when you're in the air and you know that you don't want to die, you're going to have to find a way to live, because even though you now decided, I don't need to die, which is an important distinction, I think. You still have to survive it. And when you hit the water at 75 miles an hour, how far down do you go? Like 70 feet, something like that?
I was told I went between 70 and 80 feet beneath the water surface.
I don't even know how you'd get back up, because it's so dark down there, right?
Fast.
you don't have a choice if you're going to live.
No, if you're going to live. Look, I'd like to make a point that's a little bit off of this particular topic really quick. You know, we live in a society every day that lives with disease, chronic disease of all kinds. When one has liver, lung, or heart disease, and they fight it for 5-10 years, and they die, we say, oh, the disease got them. It's too bad. They were a great person. We'll miss them. Because they died of a disease we can see, feel, touch, and hear about.
They lost their battle.
They lost their battle with that disease. Right. But when someone attempts to die by suicide or dies by suicide after battling mental illness for 5 to 10 years, we say, how could they do that? They had a family. They had everything. Why would they want to do that? How could they do this to me? We have to recognize at some point that suicide is going to capture the lives of many people. And we have to look at it differently. It's a disease. And it's a disease people die from every day.
What will it take to get it to then, for this to be a country where we look at mental illness like we do a physical illness?
Well, you have to take out the difference. Mental, physical. Why don't we just call it health? Because that's what it is. Your brain is as connected to your body as your body is connected to your brain. Your brain is the most single powerful organ in your body. And yet we look at it as if it is separate and against. It's not. It's all connected, and basically the brain controls everything else. So if that's malfunctioning, there goes the rest of you. Mm-hmm. But we can look at it differently in this country and around the globe, and we can treat people who battle mental and brain pain like people.
Let me ask Christina and Kimberly from NAMI, the National Association of Mental Illness, then. To both of you, when Kevin and advocates for suicide prevention and mental health, when we talk about treating mental illness like we do regular old illness and stop categorizing it and treating it differently, what does that look like to you? What policy changes or approaches, what can we do that starts to change that?
Well, I would just like to say that, you know, I definitely echo that sentiment that we have to look at it as a comprehensive approach. And something that someone said to me recently at a local hospital that I was working at, what we need to do is realize that this is patient-centered care, you know, and full person care. And I think that, you know, from my perspective, that is the number one thing, to stop again looking at it and saying, okay, you know, mental health is here and physical health is here. And like Kevin said, the brain is a single largest organ in your body. If that's not functioning appropriately, nothing else is going to be. And, you know, I think that with encouraged advocacy of people, you know, speaking out, telling their story, learning more, I think education is key to learning more. And, you know, just people going out and helping people understand that if you had a heart attack, you would go to cardiac rehab and you would work hard and you would get better and you'd make lifestyle choices. It's the same thing if something happens to your brain.
But sometimes, when you have a cardiac issue, you're going to need to be on medication, sometimes
Correct.
For a month or 6 months, sometimes
Absolutely.
Forever.
Exactly.
And Kevin Hines is alive today after having survived a suicide attempt. But that doesn't mean, I assume some people come up to you and say, well, you saw the light, everything's great. You know, as if it was easy.
You're better now.
Right. Yeah.
You're better now.
It's good thing you survived that jump.
Tell that to my brain.
Yeah, right. So, because, again, your diagnosis at 17 was bipolar with...
disorder type 1 with psychotic features.
All right, with psychotic features. As much as that shock moment of jumping off that bridge gave you more clarity, it didn't change your brain chemistry.
No.
Okay, so... And it also didn't mean that when you started to recover from your injuries, again, think about the approach that we have for mental illness. If I remember correctly from your book, even somebody on the Coast Guard who pulled you out of the water said, hey, man, why'd you do this?
Yeah.
You know, is that right?
Yeah. He looked at me and said, why did you do that? And I, at first they said, do you know what you did? Then I was fully awake and conscious. Why did you do that? I said, I don't know. I thought I had to die. Mm-hmm. And one guy said, you're a miracle. Put his hand on my forehead. But... to the people out there, you know, who are in fear of this medication and maybe these black box label warnings and things like that, look, you have to find out first if it's good for you. Then you have to run through the rigmarole of finding ones that work for you. This has taken me years. It didn't happen overnight. And there were those years where I got on medication. I was following a regimen. And then I said to myself, oh, I feel so much better. I'm cured. Goodbye medication. And, oh, yeah, I'm not going to tell anyone. Right back into a psychiatric unit. That's a common situation from all over the globe. And if you are going to take medication, if you are going to start a regimen, it's got to be with 100% accuracy, and it most likely has to be every day at the same time. Mm-hmm. And you have to regimen things like that in your life so you can heal better. You know, when you live with a mental illness, if you're not routining your everyday life, this can help anyone, by the way, de-stress, but education as to your diagnosis, exercise, talk therapy, meditation helps a lot of people, and mindfulness tools, refraining from drugs and alcohol while on medication, doing that is completely dangerous. I did that. I know how dangerous it is. So there's many things you can do to stabilize while living with a brain disease, a mental crisis, a mental illness. But if you don't do them, you're worse off for it and you cannot heal, because treatment does work. And if you get to a point where your body and your brain is fighting your treatment, you have to go back to the doctor and reassess what's going on and what you need to get back on track.
I even think about the fact that, so I suffer from migraines, not every day, not even every week, but I've seen an increase in recent years. That's a brain chemistry thing. And for years I took Imitrex. The efficacy kind of lessened, and I started taking Imitrex 20 years ago, and now there are new options. So I remember going to the Flaumeier Institute, Ocular Connection, and they said, look, there are more things to try. Don't just take one thing and say, well, it didn't work for me. I'm not doing any medication.
Yeah.
And it did take a little hit and miss, and that's sort of what Kevin is saying here, because I've talked to people with depression, and they'll either say, I tried something, didn't work, didn't like it, or I tried something, it worked for a while, but I'm not weak. I can do this without it.
Yet every other disease in the world you can take pills for and go, oh, yeah, I got to take my blood pressure pills today. Nobody looks at you funny. Nobody judges you. So people out there who love the people who live with mental illness, who doctors say have to take medications, stop judging them. Look into your heart and know that maybe that's something they need to do. Just like when your heart issue flares up, you take your pill.
Yeah, it's well said. We're talking to Kevin Hines, author of a book called Cracked, Not Broken, Surviving and Thriving After a Suicide Attempt. He's in Rochester today as a guest of NAMI. There is an event tonight. If you want to go see him and hear all the details of his, it's an unbelievable but believably true story, surviving that jump off the Golden Gate Bridge and then thriving and all the lessons he's learned. Again, you can get involved and go see Kevin tonight. When and where?
Tonight at the School of the Arts on Prince Street, 45 Prince Street. If someone would like to call the NAMI Rochester office, they can also do that by calling 423.
That's okay. She's scrolling through the page. That's okay. Go ahead.
423-1593.
You better do it again.
423-1593, the NAMI Rochester office.
I would actually call right now because I hope someone's over there, because tickets have been going. Kevin is in demand. He travels the world, and this is a story that I think if you love somebody and they've gone through these kinds of struggles, that this is a story they ought to hear. Kevin is an inspiring speaker, and we're talking to him this hour about what he went through. Here's another place that you can probably relate to Kevin's story, even if you haven't attempted suicide or jumped from a bridge. There are people who struggle with these thoughts, these suicidal ideations, and they think, my family would rather have me dead. I don't have a great relationship with my parents, or I owe somebody money. I'm a burden. I'm a problem. And I was moved by the story of your father, his reaction when he saw you in the hospital, because he was a strong, what did you call him? A sunset Irishman? What's the term?
An old San Franciscan. A sunset Irishman.
Old San Franciscan, a sunset Irishman, a strong man. A bruiser. So
as a kid, anyway.
You know, so he would always tell you, "I love you. Be careful."
Yeah.
But he was also a strong, tough guy.
Yeah.
You ever seen him? Had you ever seen him cry?
I had never seen the man cry, to my recollection, from being adopted to or being taken in at 9 months of age until 19 years old, the day I attempted. I'd never seen him cry until that day.
And he saw you in the hospital, and so if you think I can't fix a relationship, or they hate me, they'd rather me dead. You know, Kevin's wasn't a totally broken relationship by any means with his father, but his father was a tough, strong guy. And he sat there with you, and you almost broke me down when I heard the moment where you said, "Dad, I'm sorry." And he said,
"Kevin, I'm sorry." His immediate reaction, and we'll talk about this tonight, his immediate reaction was guilt. Guilt that did not belong to him. Guilt that belongs to no one who loses someone to suicide. If you hold that guilt, do your best in therapy to try to let it go. It doesn't belong to you. It's not yours to bear.
If you want to call the program, we'd love to hear from you. You can find us on Twitter at Evan Dawson. You can email the program, or you can call toll-free 844-295-TALK. And I'll say it again, toll-free 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. More than 2,000 people have died jumping off that bridge, and I couldn't help but wonder. And I wonder if Kevin Hines has wondered, because you're one of how many have survived a jump, 30-something?
The latest numbers are 34, and I was number 26, and of the 34, 19 have come forward to say that the millisecond their hands left the rail,
wow,
it was an instant regret.
I didn't know that. So, yeah. Since 1937, 34 survivors,
yeah.
More than 2,000 have died.
Yep.
And the majority of those who've survived have openly said, the second I was airborne, just like Kevin, what am I doing? I made a mistake. Do you ever think about the 2,000 plus who've died and wondered if they felt the same?
Every day. Every day. I know a lot of families who have lost their children, a lot of husbands who have lost their wives, fiancés who have lost their dearest, and they become friends. And my father, you know, he founded the Bridge Rail Foundation, that it was successful with a great help from mental health agencies from around the globe. To now they're raising the net at the Golden Gate Bridge. It'll be up in 3 years when the bid for building is done. there will be no more suicides at the Golden Gate Bridge by 2018. We fought for that for at least the last 10 years. And I will say this, you know, we talked about this earlier. If you are one of those people that doesn't believe your voice matters, it does. If you want to change things that you believe are wrong, you can, and one person can make a difference.
We talked about, we've briefly talked on this program in the past year when we first mentioned Kevin's story about the idea of a net there. And there will always be people who say, hey, if they don't die there, they'll find another way to die.
Just go somewhere else.
To me, though, and tell me if I'm wrong here, Kevin, this is about, putting a net on the Golden Gate Bridge doesn't cure mental illness, but the percentage of people who survive a jump there is very low. Whereas if you try suicide by other means, as long as it's not a gun, you may have a better chance to survive. And hopefully, if you survive, you can move forward and right. not try it again. Is that part of it?
There's a phenomenon that debunks that theory that they'll just go somewhere else. First of all, there's a phenomenon in jumpers that people who choose jumping by whatever means they come to that decision, which is really a compulsion, by the way. It's not really a decision. When they choose jumping, that is their only choice because of the fear of everything else. And we found that when you put up nets, barriers, and rails in tall bridges, buildings, and parking structures, and you remove the access to lethal means, you save lives not only on that structure, but in the surrounding metropolitan areas around that structure. Think about that. So when you reduce access to lethal means in any situation, you're definitely reducing suicides. Then there's people who said, and this is the biggest argument, what about the aesthetics of the bridge? The beauty of pieces of iron versus someone's life. It makes me sick. You know, it's just, you know, NAMI's doing some great work. By the way, did we mention National Alliance on Mental Illness? I want to make sure people know what NAMI is in case there's listeners that might not know what it is. You can find them at NAMI.org, yes, and find your local chapter. Is that right?
That is correct.
Okay. You know, and my wife and I are now making a film called Suicide, The Ripple Effect, about the devastating ripple effect of suicide and about the powerful ripple effect that stories of hope have to help heal people. We found that when people tell their stories of triumph over great adversity in public settings, and they do it in a way that is with safe messaging, you can have an impact that lends itself to years to come. I know a young man who heard my story from London. He's in the film. And he wrote to me this essay that I don't usually check these things online, but I happened to check it one day. And I read this essay, this, you know, 2-page-long essay, and he's telling me he's going to die. And he's telling me there's nothing I can do. And I immediately wrote to him. I didn't know what time it was in London. I wrote to him, and I got him. And we wrote back for a year and a half. And for a year and a half, the writing consisted of me trying to get him to stay alive and trying to get someone in his family to call me. Finally, I said, look, buddy, you got to give me a number, your mom, someone. And he finally did after a year and a half. And I called her, and she didn't even know he had bipolar disorder. And together, we fought together to get him to some help. And now he's a respected thespian in London, and he's doing well. And my point is that this one story, it doesn't matter that it's my story. It doesn't matter what the story is about, just that these kinds of stories can help people change their lives. And so we can reach out. We can save lives, maybe one life at a time. But suicide prevention does work, and it's everyone's business.
Let me grab a phone call. Joanne in Rochester, first up. Go ahead, Joanne.
Well, I'm calling in as a clinical psychologist for 30 years, and I just have to say I'm so grateful for this show. And to Kevin, his message is so powerful. It's a message of courage and inspiration, and that getting help when you need it is a sign of strength. And kudos to NAMI for bringing you here, Kevin. And I can't emphasize enough, there are so many people struggling silently with depression and mental health issues. And it's so important to be talking about this and to reach out. And if we know people who we may suspect are really struggling and maybe showing signs of suicidal thoughts, ask, reach out. Don't be afraid to talk about it. Devin, I am so grateful to you, and I wish you all the best in your work. You are saving lives. Thank you.
Thank you, Joanne. I know it means a lot to Kevin. What would have happened that day of your suicide attempt if someone would have asked you specifically?
It's a very important piece of the puzzle there. If someone had asked me, I had made a pact with myself. One person comes out to me and says, are you okay? Or can I help you? I would have told them everything. People just stared at me as I cried on the bus. They just stared. You could see that I was in pain. It was crystal clear. But people are in their own heads. They're in their own lives. They've got their own stuff going on. People all exist with pain sometimes. And nobody said anything. But had they said something, I would have told them everything and begged them for help. I wasn't ready to tell my father that morning. I was ready to tell someone, anyone on that bus, on the bridge.
Including the woman who approached you.
Yeah, including the woman that approached me on the bridge, yeah.
And you briefly thought, this is it.
She's going to save my life.
And what happened?
Speech tonight.
We have to save some things for tonight. One brief comment on Twitter from Amber. She says, Jessica Henderson was my friend, and her death horrified us. She was a very kind and talented young lady. If only we knew. Thank you for this. And if only we knew is something a lot of people said. Did you hear that a lot from people around you? I mean, because people, your bipolar was, it was diagnosed.
It was diagnosed. It was, you know, in and out of treatment, I would say. But, you know, this is in honor of Jessica. This is for the pain that took her. Let's as a community come together and talk openly about this subject. And when you see someone who is suicidal, just like that clinical psychologist just said, ask, are you having thoughts? Have you been having thoughts of suicide? Listen to the answer. Make eye contact. Don't look away. Don't judge. Don't say things like you're selfish or you shouldn't do that. Look at them and say, I am here to hear you. Open your ears, open your hearts, and listen. Really listen. And when they tell you what their plan is, make plans for the future. What can we do tomorrow? Let's get together next week. Who can I talk to in your circle, in your network of your personal protectors to make sure that you're safe today?
I've had some questions that we're going to get a short break. We're going to come back with questions about a number of subjects related to this. Some of you have asked about bullying and some other perhaps related issues. We'll come back in just a moment with Kevin Hines, the author of the book called Cracked, Not Broken, Surviving and Thriving After a Suicide Attempt. He is a guest of NAMI Rochester, the National Association on Mental Illness, and Kimberly Van Camp and Christina Mosgraber are here. They've got the event tonight. It's the 14th annual Jessica Henderson Memorial event. And let's hit it again, Kimberly and Christina. If you want to try to come out and see Kevin and get one of those last remaining seats, you can do that how?
You can call the NAMI office at 423-1593, or you can come out to the School of the Arts at 45 Prince Street this evening. I would recommend that people arrive by 5:30 if you're going to do a walk-in registration.
Okay, short break and more with Kevin Hines next. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on The Next Connections, Puerto Rico is in an economic crisis leading to an exodus from the island, and many of the migrants are coming to New York State. We're going to talk about that migration situation and how it impacts our community with lawmakers and people involved. And then, second hour, Rock the Future and a report card for our community on how we treat our children. Talk to you Wednesday.
Working at Napa State Hospital in California can be dangerous.
Violence is part of the daily life at Napa.
The facility is a state psychiatric hospital.
Our staff are serving incredibly ill, complicated patients that have criminal histories.
Balancing safety with treatment later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on WXXI.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Kevin Hines, my guest, the survivor of a suicide attempt in the year 2000. He jumped off the Golden Gate Bridge. He's one of 34 people who has ever done that and survived. More than 2,000 have died, and we'll probably never know the full answer of how many. It's probably more than that, but very few survivors. He's one of them. He is an advocate for mental health, essentially a more comprehensive and better policy, better treatment of mental health, not to categorize it and separate it from physical health. and suicide prevention. He's in Rochester tonight, and I want to talk briefly about bullying. Some of our listeners have emailed the program just asking various questions. And Kevin, when you were growing up in San Francisco, you write in the book that for a kid like yourself, mixed race, growing up, you felt the brunt of how difficult words and sometimes physical abuse as well, yes?
Yeah. I mean, in grade school specifically, I was treated less than by the students that were Caucasian, 100% Caucasian. And they would push me around, literally beat me up, put me to the ground and say things to me that were completely damaging, damaging to my self-esteem, damaging to my psyche. And these are things that if we think about it, the negative things we've heard from whoever said them to us since the dawn of our existence, they've stayed with us in the back of our brains. And they've become the makeups of our inner self-critical thoughts. So when you think something negative about yourself, when you say, God, you know, Kevin, you're such an idiot because you messed up at that thing, you remember when someone, you think, subconsciously you're thinking about the time that that person said, Kevin, you're such an idiot. And these things come up in your life over the history of your life, and they affect you. So my point tonight, and I'll talk about this, is that, look, you don't have to like everybody around you, and not everybody is going to like you. But try to respect that each individual you know has feelings. The toughest jock in any room has feelings. And I believe that words can do one of two things. They can damage and destroy, whether they're through the internet, through cyberbullying, or they're in person, or they can help and heal. So I ask the people who are listening, what will your words do? Will they damage and destroy, or will they help and heal? And if they're damaging and destroying other people and their lives and their self-esteem, it's time to go get checked yourself for what you're really going through. Because people only hurt other people like that because they feel they have to because they're going through something.
Mm-hmm. You're with the bullying that you experienced growing up, do you think that triggered any of your depression? I have no idea if the research connects this or does not.
So I will just say something from the group Suicide Awareness Voices of Education. Their standpoint on it is that bullying doesn't literally cause a death by suicide, but that it is a causative factor in suicidal ideations and that potential attempt. So when you think about that, you're thinking that this action, your interaction, whether online or otherwise, against someone else, perpetrating them, hazing them, hurting them on a regular basis, affects them internally and can lead to being a huge part of someone's depression that can then lead to an attempt or self-injury or self-harm.
What our friends from NAMI here, what would you tell the audience more generally about the question of whether we can connect bullying to suicide? Again, as Kevin said, maybe not a direct causation, but a causative factor. What would you want our audience to know about bullying and how it might connect?
Well, I would absolutely agree with Kevin's comments. Our words do matter, and we need to be a part of the change in a positive way. Bullying is dangerous, it's harmful, and we need to seek out ways to combat bullying in general and make sure that people have resources to turn to for children who are being and adults who are being bullied so that they can get some assistance and also so that the authorities and others can be aware of the issue, whether it be in school, workplaces, or other establishments.
I would want to agree actually with both what Kevin and Kim have said, and you know, just from my own personal experiences being bullied when I was younger and just what I've been doing now and the advocacy work I've been doing now, it's really exciting to see that there have been some things put in place to help kids when they're in that position. But just like we've been talking about too, the earlier we can reach out and help people, the better. And so just like Kevin was saying, if you feel a friend is suicidal or a colleague or anyone in your life, reach out. And that would be my same message about bullying. If you're concerned that your child or friend or someone in your circle is being bullied, reach out and help. Because just like, you know, with your mental illness, and I can speak from my own experience, I was scared. And when you're scared, you don't want to reach out. And the scared and the fear can lead to other things. and then you become more scared, and then, you know, whatever's going on can get worse. So if you see it, don't be afraid to speak up. I think that's an overarching message with all these themes.
Every time we talk about suicide prevention on this program, we hear from listeners who do say that they care and they are worried about someone, but they are scared to bring it up, especially if they're wrong. You know, if I ask someone, are you considering suicide? And they say, whoa, no, what are you talking about? Kevin, what would you say to the people who are afraid of that moment?
Okay, listen up. If you say that to someone who is not thinking it, it is not going to put the thought in their mind. They're going to look at you sideways and go, get away from me. But if you say that to someone, are you having these thoughts? Have you been having these thoughts? And they are, you have opened up a portal for them to say, grab my hand, let me take it and get you to a safe place. And that person will finally realize, I have permission to tell my truth. I have permission to talk about the thing that I was told, I thought in life that I could never talk about.
Yes, you got opening some nods across the table.
Absolutely. Opening the door can save a life.
Yeah?
Yep. Don't be afraid to open that door.
Yep.
Cheryl writes to the program and just wants to know, why did he choose the bridge, and was there a part of him that thought when he went out that day he would not go through with it?
I was compelled to go to the bridge partially because of certain websites that promote people's deaths by suicide. There are people out there, as sad and tragic as it is and disgusting, that are connected to deaths all over the world by saying to anyone, you should. And that's what they had mentioned, the Golden Gate. I believed I had to die. I didn't know that I had no knowledge that anyone had survived that fall. At the time, I had no cell phone. I had no money to get back to my house. I had only pain and tunnel vision. And so what I say today is that even when I'm in my darkest of times mentally, I have chronic suicidal thoughts. They come to me often enough. As a matter of fact, they plague me. So I guess my point here is that I've decided to commit to living. I will be here until I die of natural causes. That day, I saw no other way out.
Even now, when you're dealing with mental illness now, those thoughts do come back to you.
Absolutely.
I don't want to make any assumptions. Have you been able to stay on medication pretty continuously? Because I know in reading not only your book but seeing some of your presentations that you know, it wasn't just you come out of the water, you live, everything's easy. In fact, you've had several stays in psychiatric treatment centers. Is that correct?
Many, yeah.
Okay. And what typically led there was you deciding to go off medication first before something happened? Or is that not right?
There was a couple situations where I went off medication and I went right back into a hospital stay. There were situations where the medication I was on stopped working, mm-hmm. and that happens, and you have to be prepared for that. There were situations where I walked myself into a psych unit because if I didn't, I'd be dead. And so I want to make sure that people understand, you know, I know that in every state it's different. I know that some systems are very difficult to navigate for families and people who live with mental crisis. And I know that sometimes people go to emergency rooms to be in a safe place and they're turned away. I'm aware of that. I had a different situation. I was taken in and given the treatment I needed and gotten back on my right foot. If you can find a way in your mental struggles to become self-aware with what you're going through, you can beat all of this. And you're going to have to beat it on a regular basis. People always say to me, Kevin, aren't you tired of fighting? Yes. It's completely exhausting. When you live with this kind of brain disease, Christina, when you live with this stuff every day, it wears you thin. It wears the people who love you thin. And it is difficult. And it's difficult to take responsibility sometimes for your actions because sometimes you're out of control. But if you find a way through educating yourself about your disease to become self-aware when you have this or that symptom, you can fight it, you can beat it, and you can win that battle every time. It's a giant war that you have to fight. And I know some people don't like that analogy because war is very dark and painful. But this is an internal battle with yourself. And I do believe it is an internal war inside your head. I mean, that's what I'm fighting every day. And it's painful and it's difficult. But I will fight it because I will live, because I will never die by suicide. That won't happen, even with the crisis that occurs on a regular basis.
Kevin's story is so compelling that our friends at the NAMI office are letting us know. Don't call for tickets now. If you want to try to see the event tonight, you can show up at the door at 5:30. And the event is where?
At 45 Prince Street, the School of the Arts.
I have a feeling it's going to be something that, well, we know there's going to be heavy attendance and a lot of interest. Here's a comment from Gary, a listener, and said he's wondering about the finality of suicide. He said, considering your guest's comments on means availability regarding the Golden Gate Bridge and the story about the parent who did not know the child was suicidal, or someone who did not know their friend was suicidal, and the finality of gun violence, two-thirds of gun deaths in the U.S. are two-thirds of suicide deaths, he says, are by gun. Does NAMI support safe gun storage laws? I know it's a heavy question, but a lot of suicide in this country is by gun. I don't know if our guests take a position. Kevin, do you?
Look, I don't like guns. And you can argue that, you know, guns kill people, people don't kill people, or people kill people and guns don't kill people.
Yeah.
You can do that until we're blue in the face. But where there are fewer guns, there are less suicides. So, food for thought. You make your decision. Where they're not made available, and when they're in locked cases and only one person knows the code, there are fewer suicides.
That is true statistically, what Kevin just said. It's also true in general that where there are fewer guns, there are fewer gun deaths, suicide and otherwise.
Come on. It's common sense.
That's just a number. I think what Gary may be indicating here, and what we've talked about in recent days on this program, unfortunately, we've had a lot of gun violence to talk about, and I wish that weren't the case. But our country has more than 300 million guns now. Other countries in the world don't. 8 million guns a year are made in the world. We buy 4.5 million of them. We buy more guns than the rest of the world combined in this country. And that toothpaste might not go back in that tube. So I think what Gary's saying is, how about some safe storage laws?
I can understand that. But you know what? New York did something very interesting in downtown New York. They opened up a fake gun store where real guns were in place. And the man selling them at the front, at the corner, where in New York, in this area, their gun stores weren't allowed. But they opened this up and did a test. They filmed the entire thing. People walked in, oh, New York has guns now. I'd like to buy a gun. And a guy says, well, let me show you this gun. This gun killed, you know, Sam Smith in a massacre in 2002. Blew his head clean right off. And you should have seen the looks on these people's faces that were pro-gun. They realized that these were weapons that police reissued for this purpose, for this test, so you see what each gun has actually done. I'm not saying one way or the other. I'm saying think about it.
Yeah. And again, for our audience, I know this is always a sensitive subject, and we will always hear from people who are pro-gun rights, and I understand it. All Kevin is saying is that if you attempt to hurt somebody, whether it's yourself or somebody else, and you use a gun versus a lot of the other means possible, the gun is more likely to be fatal.
And that's terrifying. And it's also important to mention right here, right now, when we look at the news every day and people in high places in the media say things like everyone who commits a mass shooting is mentally ill, it's nonsense. 94% of people living with severe mental illness or a diagnosable mental illness never attempt to harm anyone else. 94%. Why isn't that spread throughout all of Fox News?
Okay, well,
just saying.
Okay, we've also talked about that on this program recently. And Kevin is someone who's talked about his own challenges, his own brain disease, his own efforts to improve mental health treatment around the world. One of the things that we end up sort of devolving the gun conversation to is, well, just better mental health, as if you could predict who's going to hurt somebody and then just lock them up or something.
It's not
that
simple.
No, you cannot.
It's not that simple.
No, you cannot. So we've got a couple minutes left here, and I just want to wrap with some thoughts from Kevin and our panel. I know a lot of people are going to see you tonight, and you travel around the world. And it can be, as you say, exhausting to be with someone, to live with somebody, to be a friend of someone who's dealing with this. But what would you say to a friend or a loved one who is concerned, is very aware of a diagnosis, knows about medications? You've said it's okay to say, are you thinking about suicide? Same thing when it comes to medication. Hey, just want to know, are you taking your medication?
Well, not just that, but engaging that person in conversation about what they're going through. Mm-hmm. We do it in every other situation in life. Guy's playing a sport, loses a game. Oh, you lost. I'm sorry you lost. Hey, you know, good try. You'll get them next time. Why can't we have that conversation with mental health and mental illness and what we're actually going through? I used to go into coffee shops when I was first diagnosed and wish-washing back and forth in and out of treatment and lying to myself, being in complete denial that this was my existence now and that I had to accept it and take it as such. And I'd be in a coffee shop or somewhere quiet, and I would whisper to people around me that I loved about what I was going through. Whisper, literally, like no one could hear me. And one day I thought, man, that's what I used to do with my asthma inhaler. I used to go to the bathroom to take it because I was embarrassed for being weaker than everybody else. Well, now I take my inhaler in front of anybody because I have to, because I have to breathe. And now I talk about my struggles like I'm talking to you right now at this level. And yes, people around you, when they hear these things, they will turn around and they will ear hustle and they will listen. And whatever their reactions are, that's their problem. I'm being honest about what I go through every day because in order for me to survive, I have to.
Might want to pick up Kevin's book for someone you love. It's called Cracked, Not Broken, Surviving and Thriving After a Suicide Attempt. We'll see you tonight.
All right.
It's a gift to Nami. Thanks for being here. Thanks for being here. Thanks for just being here.
Glad to be anywhere.
You know? Absolutely. Kevin makes you really appreciate just being here. And thanks to our friends from NAMI for putting this event together. Have a great night tonight. And I know we'll have more conversations on these subjects and more. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.
Thanks for listening to Connections. The engineer of this program is Valerie Labanca. Music provided by Barsook Records. And the producer is Megan Mack. I'm Evan Dawson, and this is Member Supported Public Radio.